This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before it was published as Pride and Prejudice in 1813, Jane Austen's enduring novel of manners was called First Impressions, a working title referring to that first encounter between protagonist Elizabeth Bennet and the wealthy, condescending Mr. Fitzwilliam Darcy, which, as first impressions go, was pretty abysmal.
Well, did you ever meet such a proud, disagreeable man?
Ma, he will leave you.
I don't care if he does.
A clip there from the 1995 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, which cast a young, dishy Colin Firth as Darcy. As two centuries of readers and fans know, that train wreck of a meeting evolves into one of literature's most celebrated romances, an idea picked up by Charlotte Bronte in her novel Jane Eyre, where the title character utters these words to Rochester, the man she would eventually marry.
I am not deceitful. If I were, I should say I loved you, but I declare I do not love you. I dislike you the worst of anybody in the world.
Bad impressions have become a reliable formula across literature, film, television, and pop songs. Female protagonist meets pompous jerk, only to fall madly in love with him when his sensitive side is eventually revealed. Princess Leia, Maria von Trapp, Bridget Jones, all of them wind up with men who at first made very bad impressions.
Apparently, she lives just round the corner from you.
Mother, I do not need a blind date, particularly not with some verbally incontinent spinster who smokes like a chimney, drinks like a fish, and dresses like her mother.
Yummy. Turkey curry. My favorite.
It works because all of us have gotten on the wrong foot at some point or another, clammed up in front of a cute boy or girl, said something regrettable at a job interview, or mixed up a cocktail party with a costume party. Well, today's show is all about bad impressions, and we're starting with that very first encounter, the one that tends to go wrong in romantic comedies. And contrary to what you might read in novels or see on TV, a fumbled first impression is not very likely to turn into a love story for the ages.
Individuals make impressions and judgments of other people very quickly, very easily, and with very minimal information. And then once those judgments are made, they tend to be hard to undo. They're quite sticky.
Vivian Zayas is a psychologist and director of the Personality, Attachment, and Control Laboratory at Cornell University. She's done some work studying the science behind first impressions. So we make snap judgments about others. What are we judging? Likability, looks? How do those figure in?
Those are primary dimensions on which other people are judged. Attractiveness is one. Gender, is the person that you're interacting with, a male or a female. Ethnicity, race, but also we judge things that go beyond sort of these very physical, very obvious characteristics such as gender. We judge things that are much more ambiguous, personality traits such as whether someone's extroverted. We judge sexual orientation that we would think would be hard to judge simply by looking at a person's face. We judge whether someone's trustworthy, whether they're warm, whether they're competent. All by just simply looking at a photograph of a person's face presented for a fraction of a second.
So what's more likely to have a longer lasting effect, a really great first impression or a really bad one?
In general, negative impressions are stickier than positive impressions. Part of the reason is that a lot of people make very positive first impressions. People are in general, very polite. Very kind and considerate. That's sort of the norm. And so it's not very diagnostic when someone says, hi, how are you doing? What is diagnostic if someone isn't polite, is rude, that stands out more and it's more informative. Another possibility for why the negative evaluations might be stickier is that they're more costly if we fail to make them. So if we fail to evaluate someone as untrustworthy, and they are in fact untrustworthy, they might turn around and do us harm. So those tend to be stickier from that evolutionary account.
What about interactions that come after the initial judgment made on a person's character? Any ideas about what it takes to actually change or reverse a bad first impression?
There's some work, a recent work by Nick Rule from the University of Toronto, and he was looking at sexual orientation judgments. And what we know is that people make judgments of another person's sexual orientation. They do that very quickly based on very little information. When people were given more information that was either consistent or inconsistent with that initial judgment, so say that they initially thought someone was gay, and then later on they learned that that person was actually straight, they were able to correct for their initial judgment, but it took a little bit more work. And if they were under pressure, they reverted back to their initial judgment that was incorrect. So you can undo it with a little bit of effort, but when push comes to shove, you end up going back to that initial evaluation, because that initial evaluation is based on a gut reaction that one has, and those are very difficult to change. We also know that certain people are more open to new information, to learning about new information about a particular person. And when people who are more open to this information are more likely to change their initial impressions compared to individuals who are less open.
When I was reading about your research, I thought of some of the ideas in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. You know that book? So he presented two arguments about our ability to make snap judgments. You know, one, that they are surprisingly accurate, and two, that there can be dire consequences when we are wrong. Now, what do you think about the value then of going with your gut?
Yeah. So what we see in our research is that when we're talking about characteristics such as trustworthiness, sexual orientation, things that are much more subtle to detect, that we tend to be more accurate. So we're above chance. So say, for example, in sexual orientation, if we're presented with a photograph of a person, we're above chance at judging whether they're gay or straight. We're about 60%. But 60%, it doesn't make us accurate in the sense. So if we think about a true false test, a history exam, and if someone were to be asked 100 questions that are true or false and they got a 60 on that exam, well, one would say, well, you were better than chance at your knowledge of history, but you're certainly not very competent, or you don't have a mastery of the information. There's much room for improvement. And the same thing with judgments of trustworthiness. There's research showing that we're not very accurate at judging whether another person's trustworthy or not. Many people will agree on who looks like a trustworthy person and who does not look like a trustworthy person. But whether those individuals are actually trustworthy or not is a completely different issue than whether we think they are trustworthy, if that makes sense. So Bernie Madoff was judged by many people as being trustworthy. Mm-hmm. They trusted him with his money, but he in fact was not trustworthy. So there was a lot of consensus that he looked trustworthy, but just because there's consensus doesn't mean that these judgments are actually accurate.
Vivian Zayas is a psychologist and director of the Personality, Attachment, and Control Laboratory at Cornell University. She's done a lot of research on the science behind first and lasting impressions. So there are many things we judge when we meet someone new: personality, sense of humor, level of confidence. But let's not kid ourselves. One of the biggies is their outfit. I myself appreciate fashion, an affection woefully unnoticed in the radio business. One of the most fashionable men in public radio is Jesse Thorne, host of NPR's Bullseye. His tailored three-piece suits and assortment of hats, scarves, and pocket protectors are striking for a 30-year-old guy working in a business where people are identified by their voice. Aside from steering a national cultural program and running his own podcast network, Jesse is also host of Put This On, which he describes as a video web series about dressing like a grown-up. Here he is talking with producer Taylor Quimby about how fashion can make or break a first impression.
You're well known for being pretty impeccably dressed, but do you have like a go-to fashion for that first impression? You know, it's like the first day of school, except as a grown-up.
You know, like people come into our office and our studio for interviews all the time for Bullseye, and I do try and keep my game tight, so to speak. when they are seeing me for the first time. And it actually goes back to I used to do the show out of my apartment. And, you know, like meeting someone in the lobby of my building, I just wanted them to know that I wasn't taking them up to my apartment to murder them. You know what I mean?
Like, although if you were a murderer, you might be very impeccably dressed.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, the American Psycho murderer.
Yeah, I think but I really like I tried to be aware of presenting myself professionally because I knew that it was an unusual context to walk into an interview. And I still do that because, you know, even though now we have an office, it's still just like in a loft building. You still basically have to take a service elevator to get to our office. So I figure it's nice if I show up in a necktie.
Okay, so let's think about the other side of it. What are the no-goes for you? Do you ever, you know, see somebody, they're wearing a specific article of clothing, say a beret, and it just rubs you the wrong way, and right away that impression is lost on you? They've already made an unforgivable mistake.
Right now, for me, the main thing that I have a really hard time getting over is a man in a muscle shirt who isn't literally feet in the sand on a beach. Like, the kind of you when I say muscle shirt, you know the kind I'm talking about, with a skinny strap and a big low side cut. And these are not muscle men that wear them.
No.
And you know what? If they are muscle men, that just bothers me even more because it introduces the element of how much more muscles they have than I do. But generally speaking, I don't want to be able to look sideways into a man's shirt. You know, I've lived in Los Angeles now for coming up on 10 years, and every day I become more and more deadened in my opposition to flip-flops, you know, like in normal everyday life. And I get more and more, I hate to say it, used to looking at especially men's just gnarly feet just out and about on the sidewalk. But I feel like with a muscle shirt, I can take a stand.
You know what gets me is casual attire mixed with dress wear at the same time in a way that doesn't jive. Like when you wear, you know, a suit with sneakers, I don't know why that gets me, but it does.
In Silicon Valley, you wear casual clothing to demonstrate that you are so meritorious that it doesn't matter what you're wearing because it's your merit that matters, not your clothes. In Los Angeles, you wear casual clothing to demonstrate that you're so rich that and slash successful that you can chill out whenever you want to, and you're chilling out right now even though you're having a business meeting. And I think that wearing sneakers with a suit is a good example of that. Like, it's just what sneakers with a suit says is not I'm a rebel, but I'm so not a rebel that I can do this thing that you're not supposed to do because I'm successful and rich. You know, it's like something Ryan Seacrest does.
It's like I think that's the definition of uncool, because cool is literally not trying, but trying to look like you're not trying is the antithesis of not trying.
Yeah, and you know, I'm also exhausted by normcore, which is to say, people dressing in a sort of anti-aesthetic fashion. That encompasses a kind of arrogance about one's social status and often physical attractiveness as well, if you're like Alexa Chung or something. That also gets on my nerves, maybe because I can't match it. But the idea that I can dress this ugly because I am so rich slash popular slash beautiful, and you won't confuse me with someone who didn't dress ugly on purpose.
This is a bit of a change of subject. What do you think about karate uniforms?
I think karate uniforms are pretty sweet. I used to have a karate uniform when I was little. I was way into it. I used to do that special kick a lot from the end of The Karate Kid.
The crane kick?
Yeah. There is a part of me that wants badly to wear two sets of clothing. One is hickory stripe overalls. And I want to be clear, I don't own any hickory stripe overalls. I'm not a train conductor. But there's a part of me that has the powerful appeal. And the other is just jumpsuits. I know a guy who wears jumpsuits all the time. And he's so cool. Like, it's just the coolest thing ever. He's worn jumpsuits all the time for, like, the last 15 years. If I was as solid and cool as my friend Lino, I would totally wear jumpsuits.
Isn't it funny that you can have somebody who's got almost, not a gimmick, but, you know, this one thing that they wear all the time, and it can be so cool. Like, you know, there's a lot of people I know who wear a specific kind of hat, you know, somebody who wears a fedora. And then you'll meet somebody else who, you know, rocks a bow tie every day, and it just rubs you the wrong way. And you feel terrible because you don't know why. And it's not to say that that person can't wear a bow tie and somebody else can wear a fedora, but it does seem like our first impressions when it comes to fashion are just snap judgments.
Yeah, well, I think that you convey a huge amount of information through your clothing. And to deny that is a really tragic social error. Even if the information that you're conveying through your clothing is, I'm thrifty and I buy the plainest clothes they sell at Walmart, or I like to get muddy and I only wear comfortable clothes that I bought from the L.L. Bean catalog, you know, which are sort of social identities that are in some ways anti, quote unquote, fashion. It's still something that you are putting on your body that is saying this is who I am to everyone around you. And there's no way to avoid that. There's no way to dress in a manner that doesn't convey information. So I think it's important to control what you are conveying.
Have you ever dressed so badly for an occasion that you might have created an irreversibly bad impression?
In high school, I had some Doc Martens that were covered in silver glitter. And I was going to wear them to church one day. But my stepmother, who grew up going to Catholic church in Belfast in Northern Ireland, saw me before I went out the door. And yeah, there was irreparable harm done to my relationship with her, with going to church, with my shoes. That was maybe the worst mistake I've ever made.
That was Jesse Thorne, host of Bullseye and owner of the podcast network MaximumFun.org, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. Don't chew with your mouth open, keep your elbows off the table, take your hat off when you enter a building. Or in India, never touch someone else's head. Word of Mouth returns with more ways to make a bad impression the world over. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are loads of incentives for companies wanting to do business overseas, along with some great risks. Among them, words and phrases that get lost in translation. Maybe you heard about the time American beer maker Coors brought their cool phrase, turn it loose, to Spain, not realizing that the phrase is often used there to mean suffering from diarrhea. Or when Mercedes-Benz expanded into China and accidentally translated its venerable brand name into a phrase that meant rush to die. We learned that there are many ways to inadvertently offend potential partners when doing business abroad, far beyond poor translation. Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon and NHPR's production manager Andrew Perella discuss some of the ways you can find yourself in hot water overseas.
Did you know that you are never supposed to put your hands in your pockets for longer than it takes to retrieve an object in Austria?
I did not know that.
It's true in Belgium as well.
I'll be honest, I can see that. You know, if you're doing business, you don't put your hands in your pocket.
It's a bad idea.
Yeah. Who knows what you're doing down there?
Right. Also in Austria, it is wise for you to carry a few small presents with you, because if you're presented with a gift, you need to reciprocate immediately. I mean, it seems crazy.
That seems a little crazy because I'm not big on gift reciprocation just because someone gave me a gift.
Right.
It's like, especially if it was unsolicited.
How do you know how bold to go? I mean, are you?
I know. I mean, how would you have to carry, you know, different valued gifts in your pockets for whatever occasion?
Now in Bolivia, you are never supposed to eat with your fingers. So there are utensils for everything, even fruits, such as bananas, are eaten with a fruit knife and a fork.
Does that include all sorts of
hors d'oeuvres? Yeah.
And everything needs to be eaten with silverware? Where do they stand on the toothpick question, though?
It's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't have that information. Okay. But this next one makes me think that perhaps my husband was Finnish in a former life. The propensity of Finns to remain silent for extended periods of time confuses some foreign negotiators.
And this is like beyond kind of the Midwest pause.
Yes.
Right.
I guess in general, Finns are comfortable being quiet and pretty unemotional in public. Mm-hmm. And so if they're silent for long periods of time, you're supposed to just go with it.
Those are just a handful of the many tips offered in Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands, a series of guides on conducting business abroad. To learn more, we caught up with Terry Morrison, co-author of the series, and an expert in business etiquette. Over the course of her career, she's heard a lot of stories about people making bad impressions, like this one.
I was going to relate a story about a woman scientist who was newly employed by a German management firm. And when she traveled to Frankfurt to meet her new employer, she was about 3 or 4 minutes late to the offices. When she was introduced to her new manager, she actually walked into his office, picked up a chair, and drew it closer to his desk. Then she called him by his first name and tried to crack a joke. So subsequently, the first impression that she left after this initial meeting was so horrendous that they had to have serious discussions about her future with the firm.
Terry, that sounds like a sort of powerful, assertive way to enter a conversation. It doesn't sound terribly bad. What'd she do wrong?
Initially, not being early for the appointment was the first faux pas. There are cultures that are exceedingly aware of the passage of time, and we're at one end of the spectrum, really, with the Germans and Northern Europeans, the Dutch, and the Japanese. Her being even 4 minutes late was a veiled insult to her new boss. Then not realizing that she should call him by his last name when she first meets him is also kind of a too familiar a form of introduction. The fact that she picked up his furniture, that was a grotesque faux pas, because in Germany, people are very sensitive to their space, they're territorial, and you don't touch their cars or their desks, and you don't move things around in an office.
So what do Americans most often get wrong when they're doing business abroad?
Well, some of it has to do with our approach as a physical entity. We're used to a very strong handshake and direct eye contact, and we're kind of loud. So this all comes across in the first 5 to 10 seconds, and it can be overwhelming and somewhat, you know, aggressive in cultures that really, particularly between genders, they don't touch.
As businesses around the world have become more globalized and America is a bit more of the standard, is the handshake the way that most people of business greet each other?
Yes, I would say that in general, yeah. But the variations even in a handshake are quite interesting because we have a strong grip. But if you go to most parts of Asia, it's more gentle and it does maybe last longer. I'll give a contrast one. Northern Nigeria is Islamic, and so when women greet men, many times they'll put their hand towards their chest and bow your head a little bit. That's very common. But if you are going to have a handshake, sometimes they'll put their second hand over your hand, and it's very warm and endearing, and it goes on and on for quite a while. So there's all kinds of variations to it.
Well, I was really surprised to read some of your advice on the importance of handling business cards. Tell us more.
It's a very important piece of you. It's an extension of you in Asia. You hand out cards all over Asia, and it has to be neat and clean, and you hold it with two hands as you present it.
Two hands?
Yeah, your thumbs over the edges of it. and then the writing faces the person you are giving it to. And you receive theirs with a lot of respect, and then you put it in a card holder. You never stuff it in your pocket anywhere.
So you mentioned handshakes. What are some of the other cues that you're trying to look for when doing business abroad?
Well, we live in a very low-context culture. We don't use as many gestures to mean things in the United States, but in many parts of the world, even raising an eyebrow means there's alarm or interest. So there are a lot of subtle cues in countries in Asia and Latin America that speak reams. For example, if you see someone tilt their head back in Asia, that can mean that they almost are surprised and disagree with what's happening. Their eyebrows go up. And so subtly, they're giving everyone else in the room lots of information who's Japanese, but the people from the United States really aren't watching and for that. Eye contact means a lot more than just looking at someone briefly. Even in England, they'll glance away from you periodically. It's too intrusive to have constant eye contact with people from the Middle East, particularly. Latin America, it can either be a challenge, very aggressive, or disrespectful, or very intimate. There are a lot of ways that your hands are used. Little teeny gestures with everything from your pinky in Japan to putting your hand out in a wave can mean all sorts of different things.
The story you told us earlier of the woman in Germany, she was overcompensating. She was late, maybe a little nervous, and told a joke. How about humor? How is that regarded inside of international business protocols?
Well, humor takes time. And in Germany, the whole concept is we're here to do business. And it's serious. So trying to crack a joke, even if you knew them very well, is sort of inappropriate in a business venue because time is money. So jokes are great in the United States for opening a presentation or a meeting or what have you, but they really don't translate well. There's a lot of words that have no equivalent meaning in other languages, too.
Like what?
Love, duty, all sorts of things. The word love, from my understanding in Japanese, does not translate in an equivalent manner. It's more along the lines of duty. And making the assumption that a person can understand the joke in your language, translate it back into their native language in their own mind, and then respond to you appropriately, it's a pretty large jump.
I'm curious about when people from other countries are coming to do business here. What are the kind of customs that they have to think about or be taught?
They do a lot of research generally on us. We do not do, you know, half the research that the Chinese do, for example, when they come to the United States. So they read the books, they talk to their embassies and their ambassadors, and they have lots of meetings. Once they get here, they're prepared for certain things. One is we are abrupt, we're blunt, you know, we believe that honesty is the best policy. And in many cultures, diplomacy is so important that you would actually sort of sugarcoat the truth rather than be extremely honest with someone if you had bad news to deliver. If the Japanese say to you, that would be difficult, that means, no, we're not going to do that. So they do research to how our communication styles differ from theirs. They are aware that we're very oriented towards time. We use it in 15-minute increments. They realize that sometimes we come across as initially very friendly, but that doesn't translate into lots of offers to come to dinner at your personal home.
Mm-hmm. Terry, once you've made a bad impression, once you've done that eyeball roll or whatever you shouldn't have done, is there a way to make it up? Is there a way to ask for forgiveness?
Absolutely. The most important thing is to get used to apologizing. We feel as though we don't like to say we're sorry in the United States either, because it makes us look weak, or at the worst, we could be liable and go to court because we're very litigious. But in other cultures, that's the first thing you do, is you apologize for taking up someone's time, for making an error. A grave mistake means you have to do quite a good bit of apologizing before you're even permitted to go back into the country and work there again.
Terry Morrison, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
Terry Morrison is an expert on business etiquette and co-author of the Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hand series of books on what to do and not to do when conducting business abroad. Terry mentioned the importance of correctly handling a business card in Asia. But here in the United States, if you really want to make a good impression, you have to nail down your elevator pitch, that short, sweet, sexy summary of why you are someone worth talking to. Rob Fleischman runs a technology company and often joins us to explain the digital world. So we asked him to share his tips on what makes a memorable elevator pitch.
I believe that everyone needs two elevator pitches. One I call the business card, you know, and it takes about as long as it does to hand you the card. So mine is something like, "Hi, I'm Rob Fleischman. I'm CTO of Xerocol, and we make high-performance DNS servers for internet providers. If you take my business card and say, you know, we're at a barbecue, you say, hey, that's great, here's a hot dog, I know that I no longer need to waste any more time with you going on for a minute or 30 seconds more. But if you turn around and say, oh, wow, you make stuff for internet providers? That's kind of cool. Or DNS, I know what that is. That's the domain name system. Tell me more about that." Then we launch into the more traditional elevator pitch, which I think is, you know, maybe 30 seconds to a minute. And the business card is who I am and what I do. The elevator pitch is why I do it. It's about connecting with the person on the other side. You really need to morph yourself into what they're interested in. You know, if I'm talking to a salesperson, I can't start talking about the details of the technology, obviously. But I want to talk about how what our products do can benefit them or their customers.
Okay. You've probably made a lot of elevator pitches as an entrepreneur. You've probably heard quite a few as well. You don't have to identify, but what do you not say in an elevator pitch?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first thing you don't want to do is you want to disparage your competition, which I've heard a ton of. You know, oh, my company makes XYZ and it's so much better than what you're using. Right. You know, the last thing you want to do when you're doing an elevator pitch, which, you know, again, is a type of sales introduction, is make the person you're talking to feel bad. Right. Either about themselves or choices they've made.
Have you ever bungled an elevator pitch?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I my worst elevator pitches were at conferences, you know, where you just have no idea who the audience is and you're used to just saying the same thing over and over again to a bunch of different people, and the audience turns out to be, you know, completely in a different space. I've definitely bungled a few of those. But I think – I mean, I think the analogy of my business card pitch, you know, applies to you. I mean, you know, I think you're Virginia Prescott. You're host of the Word of Mouth radio show on National Public Radio. And
New
I say,
Hampshire
oh,
Public
New Hampshire
radio.
Public Radio. I say, Virginia, that's great. What's Word of Mouth? Right? And then there's the lead-in, right? That's what you want. You want me to ask something more.
Rob, if you were to imagine, like, the worst impression that you could make, let's have it.
I'm Virginia Prescott. I work at a radio station in Concord, New Hampshire.
That is so funny because I often say that.
That's terrible. That's the worst
well,
pitch
I don't
ever.
I don't necessarily want to advertise who I am. I just say, I work in broadcasting.
Broadcasting's better. I work at a radio station. It's worse.
Okay. All right.
Broadcasting sounds – that's a more interesting word. Right?
Okay, Rob, you're at this conference. You kind of are not hitting it out of the park with these people. What do you do to reverse a bad impression? Is there any way to reel back from that? You know, ask people about their kids.
Sometimes,
talk about the cost of braces, you know.
The way I've tried to get out of that is to really try and turn the tables and ask a lot of questions of the people there, saying, okay, what is your business? What are you trying to do? What are the hard problems you're trying to solve? Basically back away from the sales pitch and say, okay, you know, our customers have some similar problems to you. And here's what we've done, or here's what they've done to help with those problems.
That was Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at Zerocoil and our explainer of all things Wired, talking to us about the elevator pitch. I'm Virginia Prescott, and I work in broadcasting. And we'll be back with more word of mouth and a story of a building that has made a terrible impression among some residents of Concord, New Hampshire. That's after a quick break when word of mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today's story is all about bad impressions. We've discussed why they lodge in our brains, how unfortunate fashion choices can cast us in an unattractive light, the varying standards and manners across the world. And for our next story on bad impressions, we turn to a building. They say that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And that holds especially true for one mid-century structure right here in Concord, New Hampshire. Jack Rodolico brings us the story.
The Employment Security Building has been called the ugliest building in Concord, New Hampshire. The building's facade is three stories of rectangles in a checkerboard pattern, each rectangle trimmed with aluminum. Now, some of those rectangles are windows, but most of them are these flat turquoise panels. The panels make the whole building look blue. And then four of those panels on the left side of the building are this kind of dull, scrambled egg yellow. And on the street, people's reactions run the gamut.
It's kind of weird looking. Strange colors.
I think it's a very unattractive building.
In its current kind of vacant state, it's a little sad.
I think it's really cool. It's different. It's not something you'd always see in Concord. I like it a lot.
Yes, unfortunately, it doesn't really fit the scheme of Main Street.
What do you think of the panels, the turquoise and the yellow?
Awful.
I hated them at first, and they've kind of grown on me the more I look at them.
I don't know why they put four yellow things there, so no.
Those panels.
Yeah, those yellow panels.
But I think there's the base there for something that could be really cool with the right renovations, kind of keeping that dated look that is probably just due to come back in style.
That last point sums up the conundrum facing mid-century architecture. Whatever you think of the way it looks, the Employment Security Building is old enough to be historic. Yet it's young enough that some people have a hard time seeing it as anything other than out of date. So the question is this: if we don't preserve buildings like this one now, while they're still somewhat out of style, will we regret it in 20 years? When the Employment Security Building opened its doors in 1960, it stood out against the Concord skyline, kind of like...
Whoa, where'd that come from?
This is Lisa Mauzoff, an architectural historian. When New Hampshire was considering selling Employment Security a couple years ago, Mauzoff was hired to write a study on the building.
It's a product of a certain period. It's minimalist. It's about its structure. It's not about being jazzy or ornamental, but it really speaks to what was going on in the state at the time.
In 1960, the U.S. was a rising superpower and state government was growing fast. Those porcelain panels lined with aluminum, that was high-tech stuff, and the turquoise and yellow were in vogue. Which is ironic because the panels are what people tend to dislike most about it now.
There's a really common trend, and again, this is based on an unscientific sampling, but that we all hate our grandmother's style.
Elizabeth Muzzy is director of the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources. Her agency took a double take when Mauzoff's study said the turquoise building was eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Like my sampling of folks on the street, Muzzy says younger people tend to be forgiving of the turquoise building, and older people like it less. But
I don't know either, because we're sort of veering into areas of psychology, and I'm a historian.
So it's not the place of a historian to talk about how we feel. But kind of, isn't it? I mean, how we feel about something determines how we value it and how motivated we are to save it.
These were considered very modern, very... The essence of a modern America. It's just like when color TVs came along and dishwashers and things like that. I sound like I'm terribly dated.
Steve Dupree runs Foxfire Property Management. When the state and city were looking for a private developer to buy Employment Security in 2013, Dupree was into it. He says the building has solid steel bones and a granite foundation.
Our vision was to remove the exterior skin and the turquoise colored panels, to put on a modern-looking skin, better energy efficiency, but to keep a very colorful element for it because we thought that would honor the history of the building, but update it and bring a major retailer to downtown.
Dupree warned the city his retailer tenant had a fixed deadline. The city missed that deadline, a second developer backed out, and Concord bought the building from the state for $1.9 million. Concord now hopes another developer will buy it to renovate or, more likely, replace. So does the demise of employment security mean the inevitable death of all mid-century architecture?
Rockefeller Center is mid-century, and all the major buildings on most college campuses, I think there's a lot of very admired buildings that are contributing to our lives.
Roy Banwell is retired now, but he designed mid-century buildings, including Concord High School, Rockingham County Courthouse, and the ski lodge at the base of Mount Sunapee. Banwell says employment security just isn't the most beautiful example of mid-century architecture. And he says mid-century buildings that are thriving today are all updated for efficiency, because when they were built,
oil cost 9 cents a gallon.
So if employment security is demolished, it may be for a lot of reasons, not just cosmetics. But it will be a unique building gone from the landscape. And just think about this. The same year the Turquoise Building went up, a block away the old Boston and Main train station was being torn down. The train station was a massive brick colonial, the exact kind of structure new design in New England often tries to emulate. And when the station was torn down, that sparked the state's modern historic conservation movement, the same movement now considering hanging on to the Turquoise Building. As soon as that train station was gone, it seems people realized what they had lost. For Word of Mouth, I'm Jack Rodolico.
Bad impressions are often formed in seconds. A sour face, an uncouth gesture, or even the tone of someone's voice can leave a yucky taste in our mouths. But for comics, nailing down a good celebrity impression is an art form that can take years to perfect. Word of Mouth's Maureen McMurray explores where some of these impressions begin and where they end, sometimes unexpectedly.
For Gilda Radner, it hinged on a slight speech disorder.
Hello, I'm Baba Wawa.
For Eddie Murphy, it began when he was a child watching TV, and he would imitate what he saw on the screen.
Hi, I'm Buttwee. Remember me?
For Josh Rubin, it all starts with a breath.
That's Nicholson, Hoffman, De Niro. This is De Niro. It's like a little higher or something. I don't know. Bridges is a... I've never breathed in as him, but... Hey.
Josh Rubin is a comedian, actor, and director for College Humor Originals. He does a bit of stand-up, but is most known for his impressions. Among them...
Hello, I'm Robert De Niro.
Alan Rickman.
And now for the Weekend Update movie review.
Anne Ramsey from Goonies.
How am I supposed to afford my medicine?
He also does Christoph Waltz, Sharon Osbourne, Isabella Rossellini, and Jesse from Breaking Bad.
Okay, like, in other news... Hostess filed for bankruptcy, which is, like, really sad. They're, like, $900 million in debt, which is, like, a lot of cheddar, yo.
But among the characters featured most prominently in his act, his sketch videos, and on his reel are these two well-known voices.
Thanks for being my acting coach today, Mr. Hoffman.
Yeah. Oh, God. You're welcome.
It's not your fault. No, really, it's not your fault. No, promise you, man, it's not your fault, man. I promise you. No, really, Will, it's not your fault. Sorry. Can I take that again?
In case it's not already abundantly clear, he was imitating Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robin Williams.
Yeah, it's been a hard year for heroes of mine.
Josh has been doing impressions of Hoffman and Williams for years, long before he even embarked on a career in comedy.
I mean, I as a whatever 14, 15-year-old kid, I would watch World According to Garp like again and again and again, beyond every other movie that, you know, he's sort of known for. So I just would kind of find myself sort of talking, you know, just a little, you know, quicker like this, and he would he'd be talking, and his jaw would sort of move a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right. And I had watched so much of his stuff and admired him so much that I would find myself sort of talking like him. You know, I was a bit of an unpopular kid in junior high, and I would go to these, you know, certain number of impressions to, like, get people laughing or to get attention or whatever. So it's like those impressions are sort of an extension of me. They have been for a certain number of years, Phil for less time and Robin for more.
Which all leads to a pretty tricky question. What happens to a good impression when the impersonated dies?
Feel a little stunted. Like I had something I was going to audition for that I actually canceled yesterday because you know, they were asking me to do certain characters, and the most fun ones to do were Robin and Phil. And Phil, because they do it sort of, he's just sort of the road less taken in terms of impressions. And Robin, you know, when you'd meet someone, and even though I never ever really liked it when people would go like, "Hey, this is Susan. Meet Susan. Oh, do your Robin Williams. You do a really good Robin Williams, or do your De Niro. Do your Kevin Spacey or whatever," and, you know, you just kind of like roll your eyes. But it's kind of a sad thing to not for that to be inappropriate now. And it does sort of feel stunting to me because I love to do them. And I'll admit I've kind of been talking a little bit like Robin in private, not like a crazy person, but like, you know, just like the lines that I used to do, like, "Oh, the moon like a testicle hangs low in the sky." Yeah, well, you know, divorce is a Latin word for having your testicles ripped out through your wallet.
So, I mean, you said that you have kind of trotted these impressions out, at least privately. Have you brought any of them out publicly since the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robin Williams?
You know, when I did the Pete Holmes podcast, Pete's, you know, my buddy, and you know, we are both huge Philip Seymour Hoffman fans, and, you know, Pete's a comedian, and I'm, I guess you could call a comedian. And one of the first things, you know, we did when I got on his podcast, I mean, within the first few minutes was, you know, just us going, "I'm dead. I'm dead. Oh, God."
You do it.
"I'm dead." I'm dead.
There's, well done.
"I'm dead."
Do well done.
Well done. That's just how we, you know, two comedians are dealing with, you know, the tragic death of this incredible person. It's just like, oh, God, we got to make a joke about it because we're covering up how sad we really are. And Robin, to me, is just like, you know, Robin Williams is just untouchable. I can't even think I just, you know, choke up even trying to do him, even as a joke.
They say that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And maybe it's true. Just 2 days after Robin Williams' passing, Jimmy Fallon tearfully honored him on The Tonight Show and found himself falling into an impression.
You wouldn't even, if you don't know his stand-up, you should YouTube it right now and just watch it. He's just amazing. He was funny, and he was fast, and he would weave in and out of characters. He would get Shakespearean. He would just get into, like, "Oh, yes, thank you. Yes." Then there's a guy sitting at home going, "What the hell is going on there? Yes." Then there's a kid going, "That's not the way. Yes." Then he's like, "Martha Graham, Martha Graham," and ball and chain and kick and ball and, "Yes, thank you."
Chevy Chase's brutal impression of President Gerald Ford centered on him bumbling and falling around.
"I do have two major announcements to make." "Whoop, uh-oh. No problem, no problem. No problem. Okay."
Yet in 2007, days after President Ford died, Chevy Chase wrote a heartwarming op-ed for the New York Times detailing his friendship with the man he ridiculed. Charlie Murphy made his career on Dave Chappelle's show when his outrageous Rick James stories were turned into skits.
"We're going to hang out with Rick James tonight, you know what I'm saying? And he comes out the room, and I look at him, and I'm not bullshitting, man. I seen like an orange, his aura or whatever. I seen it. He's orange."
But when Rick James died, Charlie was an usher at the funeral. The list goes on and on. So yes, imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but for the impersonator who truly loves his target, it can also be really painful.
Even when I find myself just sort of talking to myself as an impressionist probably does just to develop their repertoire, you know, you come upon these like old friends, and some of them are living and some of them are dead. And it's what's just crazy about it is that they were both acting heroes. It's like, well, Jesus, there they all go, you know, they're all my heroes.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Maureen McMurray.
Well, that does it for today's show. We do hope it made a good and lasting impression. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have a go-to impression that you bring out at parties and family gatherings? Maybe you do a great Robert De Niro or Sean Connery or Christopher Walken. If so, we'd love to hear it. You can leave a message on our listener line at 603-223-2448. And if your impression is more visual, you can send us a video. You'll find instructions on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah, I want a cheese pizza. Scratch that. I'm so hungry. Can't even think straight. Can I actually get a